I popped into the dry cleaners the other day with our son to pick up some trousers. So there's a new guy working there, and he's very nice. He's quite chatty. But it's all nice until he gestures towards our son, and he says to me, "Oh, is that your grandson?"
How did that make you feel?
Not good.
No.
No, I mean, I'm a slightly late in life father in that I became a dad at the age of 43, but that's not that uncommon in our North London neighbourhood.
No, but your hair has gone not grey, but white, and you're letting it grow out. So you have a large fluffy halo of not grey, but white hair around your head.
But you wouldn't let me dye my hair as it started to go. You forbade me from dyeing the hair.
I initially thought it was a no. We spoke to some experts who were like, "I don't think that's right."
You say that like we,
but we know
like
a
we
hair
had a
expert.
Rare disease, and we went round no, contacting a variety of experts.
We went private on your hair. No, we know a hair expert, Michael. He made me feel very considered in what I consider to be our plight. And was like, I don't think that's the right answer.
Here's my question to you. Why not just lean into the white hair and go for like a mad scientist look like Doc Brown from Back to the Future or Albert Einstein?
How would you feel if I let my hair go mad white? You'd be physically repulsed by me. Because
I would not.
You would. You
I would
feel...
not. Your mother has white hair. I am not physically repulsed by her.
Do you want to fuck my mom? No.
Maybe some heavy petting. Maybe just some fooling around.
But
my point is this. It is an acknowledged attractive thing on a man. Albert Einstein had some kind of thing with Marilyn Monroe, and he was renowned for being this sexy figure because of his cunnilingus stuff.
That's
what?
Gross.
Why is a scientist mad if he's got wild hair?
He just is.
Why is he not just a not vain scientist? Maybe he is working hard on his Nobel Prize winning theorem, and yes. He hasn't got time for hair maintenance.
Yes, he's working hard on that theorem, and his wife and her needs are neglected as a result of that.
Maybe his wife likes it.
She doesn't.
We have an exciting guest.
I don't like to play, you know, any kind of favorites. So she's no more or less exciting than anybody else.
Now, a show we love is Girls 5 Ever. The first two seasons were on Peacock. What? And now it's all on Netflix as the third series as well. It is about a 90s one-hit wonder girl band who reunite in middle age in their 40s. It is filled with jokes, and I would say the jokes land far more often than they don't. The main cast are phenomenal. And because it's about a band, it has songs in it, and the songs are fantastic.
I just love it so much. It's the comedy that you were asking for.
And we have for you on this episode the creator of Girls 5 Ever, Meredith Scardino.
So my quick watch this week, I watched Past Lives, which Rosie Jones mentioned to us. And it's a film that follows these two friends from the age of 12 to about 36 years old. So we meet them in the beginning, living in Seoul, and then her family, it's a boy and a girl, her family emigrates to Canada. And then we meet them 12 years later, and she is now living a grown-up life in New York City, trying to be a writer, and he is still in Seoul. And they find each other because of social media. And so this long-distance, not-in-person romance kind of develops. But what are they doing, Jeff? She's in New York. She's not going to Seoul.
They're on opposite sides of the globe.
What are they going to do?
We made it work.
We did, but that was because of both of our respective desperations. And the availability in both our schedules. We didn't have anything to do.
No.
Except love each other. So she eventually goes, no, what are we doing? They decide to not talk for a while. And then 12 years after that, we're now in the modern day. They're now in their mid to late 30s. The film leads, no spoilers, to him finally coming to New York and them spending some time together as adults, but she's married.
Is it a bit like One Day only, instead of meeting them every year, you're meeting them every 12 years?
Ish, but I think it's better.
Right.
Like One Day was good, but it was a bit of a cheese factory.
I think you call that a dairy.
Oh, yeah.
So the story is split across New York and Seoul.
Yes.
Did it make you long for your former home of New York, or did it make you want to explore uncharted territories and go to Seoul?
It didn't make me go, do you know where my Seoul home is? Seoul. The reason for that is the sky was not blue enough. Like a beige sky never makes you go, this is my place. And the sky in Seoul was a little too beige for me to want to go into it. However, what I think I could get into is there's a moment where one of the characters wakes up one morning and the mother has put a full breakfast out for everyone. But there's no eggs. There's no porridge. There's no cereal. To me, as a Western woman, it just looks like full Korean savory dinner presented at breakfast. And this, I realize, is what my body is always asking me for. Why aren't we doing that?
Your mom has a very strange breakfast routine.
She wakes every morning at 5 a.m. to do her morning routine, which my father has pointed out to me lasts for 6 hours. She wakes, goes downstairs, and I think begins the process of brewing some kind of tea that involves, I think, turmeric and ginger. Then she does a lot of kind of like stretches and exercises. Then I think she goes on a walk to the water. She lives near the lake. Then I think she makes herself an omelet, but with every possible vegetable that you've ever imagined. When we were last in Chicago, she made me an omelet with beetroot in it.
I would say that omelets are her compost.
Yep. She views it as a receptacle so she doesn't have to throw food out.
Yes.
So then she reads the paper.
And while she's doing this, she has weighed out to the gram various bowls of nuts and seeds that she has in the exact right amounts. Mm-hmm. Is she chewing parsley? Is that a thing?
Yes. I really respect the ritual. I really do.
She doesn't like to interact with any other humans during those 6 hours.
No.
Which I would say is a large chunk of your waking day to have a no-fly zone around you.
Yeah.
I just want to be left alone just for 6 hours.
I want to be in the living room, but no one just... I'm in the main shared living space, but please no one look at me. No one make direct eye contact with me for 6 hours. But I'm in the main space of the house.
I feel like hearing that morning routine description, it's like she was cut out to be a celebrity. So what is it that you enjoyed so much about this film? Is it that it's smart about people and relationships?
Guys, this film was so wonderful.
Is it rom-com?
No.
It's not a com?
No.
Is it rom?
Rom.
But also
sad rom, right, real rom, yeah, life rom. This is
melancholy,
life, melancholy rom.
I'm into it.
Human rom.
I'm going to watch it.
Human rom. Hundy P for human rom.
You may remember a couple of weeks ago, Lindsay Skeen recommended in our inbox that I watch a documentary on BBC iPlayer called A Bunch of Amateurs. So I took Lindsay's recommendation, I watched it, and it was excellent. So it's a club, a small social club, and they are amateur filmmakers, the Bradford movie makers. They meet in a dilapidated clubhouse. I don't think I ever counted more than 12 members.
Uh-huh.
We're not joiners, are we? We don't belong to any clubs.
No, it's very difficult for us to participate.
When I went from primary school to big school, I had a little difficulty with it. And my dad suggested that I join a social club.
Oh, honey.
And I joined a club on his suggestion, Trainspotters Club.
Do you feel that the reason your dad selected that club for you is because he went, this is where the losers are and that's where my son fits in?
This kid isn't going to cut it on a sports club.
Right. Like, of course, music was much more your thing, but probably your dad was thinking, band isn't nerdy enough for my boy.
I think band isn't a thing here in the way it is in America.
I was in marching band for like a little bit of time and I learned how to play Call Me Al. It's like my one thing I could play on the flute while marching.
Are you talking about the flute solo in You Can Call Me Al?
Do, do, do,
oh,
do.
Not the...
No.
No.
That was a good rendition.
Thank
of
you.
That, though.
Thank you very much. This film is charming. So it is extremely northern. It looks like my childhood. The members are mostly older. They all look like they could be uncles of mine. And you get to learn a bit about their backstories. Oof. And it's too heartbreaking.
Yeah.
The couple that you see the most of, both in different ways, care for their wives.
No.
Because the people in this film are old and because it's set in the north, when problems arise, there are two things wheeled out to make things better. Tea and biscuits.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to give you some names of British biscuits. I want you to put them in order of least to most disgusting.
Okay.
Malted milk. Hobnobs.
This is making me feel so sick.
Ginger nuts.
That's acceptable.
Rich tea.
Okay.
And fig roll.
Okay. So the only one of those that doesn't make me want to kill myself is a ginger nut. Then I'm go... Rich tea is a question mark. I don't know. So I'm going to go that that's second best. But I might live to regret that. Then I guess the fig roll, which, I mean, a fig to me is more elegant fruit than some of the other disgusting fruits out there.
Not when it's in a fig roll, it isn't.
Malted milk and hobnobs are freaking me out.
What if I told you the malted milk has rendered in biscuit a pastoral scene on it?
I mean, that's pretty. I would have liked it, but I'm not a child.
American biscuits superior, you think?
Yes. Like, if I could meet these pieces of shit with some, like, Girl Scout cookies, we'd 100% kick your ass. Like, a Thin Mint? Shut up. I mean, it was just a much better, a Pepperidge Farm.
A what?
A Pepperidge Farm cookie.
A farm cookie?
No, Pepperidge Farm. Pepperidge
Farm. Why are they baking biscuits on a farm?
You're getting this all wrong. You're really irritating me.
Why are they not plowing the fields and scattering and milking and slaughtering animals?
This is like a pristine farm. It's the kind of farm that's like open for business, not like dark shit. Like you see a sign for that farm on your holiday and you go, should we take a family trip to that nice farm? And maybe you see like one clean pig, that kind of thing. Pepperidge Farm. You've 100% had Pepperidge Farm cookies when you've been in America.
I haven't.
So Pepperidge Farm is like better than the best this country has to offer.
People in this country do not like it when you insult their biscuits.
Well, deal with the tough truth, motherfuckers. Like, this shit is disgusting.
So I would definitely recommend this film.
Would you?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's okay. Lovely. And it's funny. And what this film is really about is community, people finding each other, people learning to get along with each other, and it's about loneliness.
Oy vey. I don't like loneliness. You know that. I will do nothing to help those people, and I don't want to be reminded that they're out there.
We would love to hear from you. Have you seen Past Lives? Did you agree it? Do you have thoughts? Also, broadly, the subject of Korea.
Korea.
Have you got anything else from Korea?
Korea.
For us. Also, TV that you want to eat, inspired by Past Lives and The Breakfast.
Something that helps you, that made you hungry for a new kind of lifestyle.
Have you changed your diet based on something you've seen on TV?
Right. Like, if suddenly I was like, there's going to be like a lot of kimchi in my morning.
Also, based on Bunch of Amateurs, what is the thing you've watched that is most like your childhood? The Ian Curtis film, Control, was filmed on the streets I grew up on.
And so exciting.
And it was the era as well. They made it look like that era. That was a wonderful thing. Although there's some old film footage shown in a Bunch of Amateurs. And it made me think, as good as production design is on all these shows that are period pieces and they get the 80s just right, or whichever era, I'd like to say they really don't. Everything was much, much browner than you imagine. It was far browner than you remember it being. And another thing, we don't do much of this, but I just want to tease that next week we have a guest on the podcast who has been sitting at the top of our wish list for some time.
Yep.
And we managed to bag them. If you want to play a little guessing game as to who it is, you can email in with that.
That's fun, Jeff. Yeah. Yes. Who did we get?
Yeah, because you'll hear next week and it is really exciting. And as an extension of that, who would you like to hear?
Oh, I like how you're thinking. This is very good. Yeah. Do you have a little wish list? And I think sort of anything goes, right?
Yeah. I mean, not like Shamima Begum.
No, I don't know. We're
not going to do those types of interviews. But generally, if there's a showrunner, a creator, a writer, or maybe somebody appears on screen, who would you like to hear on the podcast? The email address is?
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com. Do you want to give me a style?
Eurovision?
Patreon.
I think Eurovision is probably too big an ask, right?
Look, we're thinking about a dog. Dogs are not cheap. I know you want us to get a rescue dog, which does no one else question a rescue dog? If you've had a rescue dog for 10 years and then you have a baby, fine. But I'm just saying, if you have a child who possibly couldn't defend themselves against a dog gone rogue.
If there was no child in the house, I would want to devote the time, to, like we do in all our relationships.
Of course.
To helping somebody grow into the person they were always meant to be.
Of course.
But we don't want a situation before we have completed that process of psychological healing. We don't have a situation where the dog has bitten our son's face off.
We need money if we're going to bring a dog into our lives.
Oh, yeah.
We're researching. We're going to have to pay for all this shit. It's a long-term journey.
There's insurance. There's vet's bills. There's the feeding of the dog. We're going to have to buy some squeaky toys.
All you need to be asking yourself is, how are we going to pay for it? We need money. You can give it to us for all the work that goes into this pod, for your watch list, for the extended interviews, Friday voice notes. Wow. I talked about some very riveting shit this week, Jeff. Just show us that you love us. Just help us get the right dog.
And we're past the point where there was a standoff between you and our son over the name. He wanted to call it Jodie Whittaker. Mm-hmm. You felt strongly that you didn't want a dog called Jodie Whittaker.
Not doing it.
And the two of you have now compromised on Kermit the dog.
Yeah. You guys, your Patreon money helps fulfill the dreams of a child. The dreams of a child!
Patreon.com/theyliketowatch. And coming up later on this podcast, we're just delighted to talk to Meredith Scardino. Can you give a song title from the show, just to give a flavour of it?
TBF, Tiny Butts Forever.
Tiny Butts Forever.
It's so good.
Later in the podcast, we talk to creator and showrunner of Girls 5 Ever. Season 3 is available on Netflix now, Meredith Scardino. This week, together, we watched Shogun. And this is a major series. It's on Disney Plus here, I think, FX in the States. And it's set in Japan in the 1600s. Let me set the scene.
Uh-huh.
There is a power vacuum because the old leader has died and his son and heir is still a child. They don't want a little lord, so there is an interim caretaker in charge. However, the leaders of the various fiefdoms are on manoeuvres. But it's a delicate power balance, and it's partly maintained by alliances with Portuguese Catholics with their newfangled weaponry.
It's very complicated.
But the inciting incident is a Dutch ship washes up on shore. On board is a charismatic English pilot called John, and he can potentially put the cat amongst the pigeons because he's European. He knows what's been going on in that half of the world. He hates Catholics and he can blow the whole gaff on how the Spanish and the Portuguese are carving up the globe. And they are, in fact, colonialists.
Where was that information last night when I was continuously going, do you know exactly what's going on right now?
I think it was one of these where I said, let it wash over us and then we'll figure it out. But it took me a couple of episodes to get there with that stuff.
I'm still working on it.
So I think the closest thing is Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And that is something about the scale of it. But there are no zombies or dragons or anything like this.
Right. I guess what feels so Game of Thrones is...
Thrones.
Game of Thrones. It's very Game of Thrones-y. Number one, the opening credits, which are terrible.
You don't like them?
I think they're awful. Someone should lose their job over those opening creds. But it's also Game of Thrones-y because it's about many families battling. So many characters get thrown at you in these first few episodes.
And one thing I do like is that the different factions have different looks. So there are various colored tunics or haircuts.
The impression I get of the Japanese as a people, follicularly, is they're blessed. They're a blessed breed in terms of their hair.
Thickness of hair.
Yeah, I once accidentally booked myself into a Japanese hair salon. And so, like, I had, without exaggeration, 1/20th of the amount of hair that the women and men on either side of me had. Like,
Did a small crowd gather?
But if they were allowing themselves to do what they wanted, they would have been like, look at this lady who has 1/20th of the hair that we all have.
There have been 4 episodes of Shogun so far, and people are starting to talk about it, I've noticed. So far, and there are some strong female characters, so I think it might go in a different direction. But it doesn't seem like it's going to be passing the Bechdel test anytime soon.
No, there are not strong female characters in this.
Mariko?
Fuck you.
Mariko.
Is she the one? Is she the translator? First of all, she looks like a model. It's like a male fantasy of what a strong female character is. I feel like a rule that we generally are starting to understand is we're getting a bit finished looking at tits. We're looking at dicks now.
Yes, that's one of the ways in which Game of Thrones feels a bit dated.
I feel like I've seen a lot of penises in shows recently, and it feels great. It's like, yes, thank you. Like, show me a dick instead of tits. Or at a bare minimum, if you're going to show me some tits, then show me a D.
But shouldn't it be a bush for a D and a tit for a ball?
No, no.
Or a buttock?
No, a buttock is nothing.
Okay.
Okay, so take butts off the table. And I appreciate in a way that a dick is more vulnerable than a tit. And I'm saying that because I would be pretty comfortable showing someone my tits and less comfortable showing my B, my bush. So I understand there's not quite a tit for dick equiv, but we've been through decades and decades and decades of women's bodies being exploited and women having to show themselves. So I feel like what we all know now is, for all intents and purposes, tits and dicks are equivalent until we bridge the pay gap. I think that should be the rule. And what I didn't appreciate about this show is that we get this extremely erotic presentation of two tits.
One at a time.
She goes one at a time. There's one. Oh,
that's the other.
There's another. And I'm not saying that it's a terrible piece of TV, but do not come at me about a strong female character when you're showing me tits and no dick.
Anytime I see something set in the past, it just makes me more and more glad that I live in the present.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I know some people will watch historical drama and think, oh, just imagine what it'd be like. And I do imagine what it'd be like. And I think scurvy, brutal executions and torture, like horrible imprisonment. However, one thing I will say about this show is the bathing is very satisfying. Japanese baths. Like, it's much better to see something set in Japan, hygiene-wise, than it is something set in medieval England.
Yeah, they seem incredibly clean, and British people seem disgusting.
Love a Japanese bath.
Have you ever taken a Japanese bath? Or you just sort of like the aesthetics of a Japanese bath?
I like the setting, and I've been to a Japanese hotel not in Japan.
Oh.
And done all that. One of the things is they give you little slippers to put on,
which
deliberately slow you down as you walk along the corridors because it forces you into a more relaxed, contemplative, meditative, is that a word?
No.
No. Like, frame of mind.
I especially appreciated the baths because I can get into a thing where I watch TV sometimes where if a character is very dirty, I cannot relax into the viewing until they bathed themselves. So one of the most memorable things was The Hateful Eight.
Oh, yeah.
That Tarantino film. And Jennifer Jason Leigh, like, kills someone and is covered in blood and dirt. And then she just stays that way through the whole film. And I just thought, just bathe her. Like, just please bathe her so I can continue to follow the storyline.
I would rather have somebody clean and have, like, a niggling little continuity question in my head about how did she get clean? Mm-hmm. Then I would just look at a dirty person for a whole film or TV show.
The first episode of this is pretty excruciating. Spoiler alert, they boil someone alive to torture him and then someone's baby gets killed. But I was less disturbed by the boiling alive than these fucking unshowered people on the ship. Because I couldn't even really take in boiling alive. But I was looking at these grimy British motherfuckers being
the
like
scurvy. And eat fucking, an orange. Eat and their, an orange.
Their teeth and welts on their like.
Or a clementine.
Oh God.
Just a tangerine would be fine. Apart from an orange, I don't know the difference between any of the other things I've just named.
I know the difference between all of them.
Tangerine, satsuma, clementine. I think they're all the same thing. Is it just arranging them in size order? So it goes orange, tangerine, clementine, satsuma.
No, I don't know. Another example of me claiming something that I... claiming knowledge that I absolutely don't have.
One of them looks more festive because it's got...
Oh, that little one with that little leaf. Yes. Shut up with the leaves. Those festive little leaves.
One.
That is the cutest one with that little leaf out the top. Like, I'm just with you wherever you were and you were flown to me and it killed the environment. But I just... I don't think about that detrimental journey. I just think about, if only I lived near orange trees.
Maybe you will. We should say that this show is mainly in Japanese, so it's mainly subtitles, but Cosmo Jarvis's John speaks English in an Obi-Wan Kenobi voice. And then there are Portuguese characters who speak English with a Portuguese accent. So it's like an hello, hello type of thing going on in Portuguese. And I can only imagine that there would have been conversations about, well, should we have them speak Portuguese? But then will people know which ones are Japanese and which ones are Portuguese? Maybe Portuguese could be one color Japanese. And then they thought, no, let's just make them speak English with a Portuguese accent.
Yeah, I didn't quite...
You're not quite on board with that.
I really need to follow the journey that the show is going on. I'm glad to know that there were only four out yet because it makes me feel like maybe we can stay on top of this one and maybe we would.
And I think it is good. I think it is a serious, weighty piece of television.
It seems very informed, Very interesting. A little too complicated for me to follow, but I'll take responsibility for that. And I'm very, very upset about the titty and the peen. But, you know, maybe it's going to show me some D later on. I don't know.
And sorry if the person who designed the opening titles is listening. I quite like them.
You quite like them? It's like artless.
Let's not let this become a thing in our marriage. Are you watching Shogun? Send us your notes, thoughts, and queries. Also, is there a show where the hair ruins it for you?
Oh, that's good. Can you think of any off the top of your head with that?
Not ruins it, because this is a show that I love. But I've said before that I find some of the wig mastery in Righteous Gemstones just a little bit much for me. And who's right about the opening titles, me or Sarah?
I feel so disconnected from you. I'm very surprised that you like them.
The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
And coming up, we're talking to the creator and showrunner of a sitcom that we both really like because it is just relentlessly filled with jokes. We liked it from the off, but then there was a moment, I think, is it in episode 2 or 3?
In season 1, where she introduced us to one of the
refrains,
but also it was like she told us who we are. We didn't understand who we were until she introduced us to the New York Lonely Boy.
I mean, I'm loath to sit here explaining how a funny joke in a show is going to play out if you haven't seen it, but it's a laser sharp skewering of a certain type of parent of an only child living a metropolitan life. And when we saw it, we simultaneously felt mocked and seen and like we'd found a show that was for us.
Yes.
So we're going to be talking to her about New York Lonely Boy, Girls Five Ever, writing on US talk shows, her career as a writer, working with Tina Fey. She is fantastic. Coming up next, it's Meredith Scardino.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We are the parents of a New York Lonely Boy, but in London. So it is now an international franchise.
Oh, I would like to know some of the characteristics of a London Lonely Boy.
Okay, he likes to go for afternoon tea in the finest hotels. A friend of ours who is a Savile Row tailor made him a waistcoat and spiffy trousers.
Come on. My son, for his 5th birthday, asked for a tuxedo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a video of him getting it that I have resisted putting online because I feel like I know it will go viral.
When we were first watching the New York Lonely Boy episode, we were side by side in bed and the song came on. And I went, Jeff, and he went, it's a little too uncomfortable for me. And I went, but you know it's funny. And he goes, I know it's funny, but I need a beat.
Okay, good.
It was painful, but we felt very seen and mocked
good.
At the same
okay.
time.
Yeah. Well, my son knows all the words and sang it the other night. And one time he did ask me if it was about him and he goes, but I'm not lonely. I go, no. I know you're not. No, it's not you that's lonely. It's that like that there's one like wonderful. These are the best kind of kids, you know, like he's like, OK, yeah, yeah. He's like, but I like that stuff.
In preparation for this, we watched all of season 3 yesterday. Then we treated ourselves to a rewatch of 1 and 2. So this in mind, my son said to me the other day, he said, Mom, why do you keep saying tiny butts forever? Do you catch yourself with all of the songs running around inside your head? Does that happen to you?
Yeah, usually it happens after I've been working on one or in an edit. Our music team, Jeff Richman and his awesome team of musicians, they make these earworms. I never know how they do it. They feel like magicians to me.
Have you seen any of the melodies appear out of thin air?
No, because they're born a lot of different ways. Typically, the lyrics come out of the writer's room and then kind of send over like oh, here's the vibe of the song. I oftentimes, with my awful voice, will send a voice memo of kind of a really, really rough idea of what it might sound like, knowing full well that my version is very like restricted and just always sounds like the same NSYNC song or something. And then they turn it into actual music. But what? Jeff also sometimes, he might be like, hey, Mare, we need a bridge here. And the first season I was like, okay, Googling bridge. What's a bridge? But yeah, that was like a really fun way to collaborate.
Does any of it feel like markedly easier or harder than the other writing stuff that you've done?
The way you write a song is very different. You have to kind of pull back a little bit on the joke because when it's too jokey, it starts to feel weird.
How often are you on Rhyme Zone?
Oh, I'm keeping it in circulation. I'm pretty sure I'm probably their most trafficked. I'm always on Rhyme Zone. And I love near rhymes. Like you can do that drop down.
Yeah.
You can do near rhymes. You can do, I think, poems or something. Maybe, always on Rhyme Zone.
Rhyme Zone should get a co-write.
Yeah.
So you cut your teeth on talk shows. When you're pitching a joke in a room, how big do you go with your performance of the joke? Because if you mumble it, it gets lost. But if you get too big, people are going to think you're getting ideas above your station, right? If you do too much of a performance.
Well, I sort of just shout everything is my style. I used to, when I worked at the Colbert Report, you kind of have a limited amount of time because you have a show every day. So I was just so always used to pitching like it was an emergency. And then I'd be like, okay, so yeah, all right. Just screaming the whole, at one level. Everyone has a different style though. That's mine.
Right. Before Colbert, you did like more than 300 episodes of Letterman.
Oh, was that how many it was? Yeah.
So it says on the IMDb. If David Letterman saw you in the street, would he know you?
No.
It must be a weird thing.
What? Maybe he might. I don't think so. I didn't interact with him when I was there. I saw him like twice.
Do you have an idol or anyone who would make you nervous?
Oh, not to be cheeseball, but it is really Tina Fey and Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
And I worked with them and it's awesome.
With Tina Fey, how long did it take you to be normal around her?
I'm still working on it.
Right.
But I have this funny problem sometimes with her where I, for a while in the beginning, I wouldn't notice when she was in the same room as me and then I would scream. So like I would come into the writer's room and just be talking, you know, whatever. And then I would just not, for whatever reason, like I just wouldn't clock her. She's like sort of, she can keep a real low profile when she wants to. She's really good at like blending in at an airport. Anyway, many times I have walked into a room, been blabbering about something and then just gone, ah, hi!
She's behind you.
Is she a generous laugher?
She's not the loudest person in the room. Like she's kind of soft, more soft spoken. I mean, you can get her to laugh. And to me, it's catnip. And it's my whole life mission to just make Robert and Tina laugh is like all I ever want to do. And I'm like, what do you guys think of this show? Did it make you laugh? And because it's the best when you make her laugh. And when I make Robert laugh, it is just dopamine.
Yes.
It's like a huge rush of dopamine.
For anyone a bit interested in comedy, this idea of being in the room at Letterman or in the room at SNL or in the room at Colbert is like everyone's dream. But then the reality is like you get a job there and your hair starts falling out because it's so stressful and it's not easier when you're a woman. Were you sort of able to enjoy it or was it like
I loved
cold
it.
Sweats? You did.
I loved. Okay, so I worked at Colbert for 6 years, but I left because I read Robert and Tina's script for Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And I loved it so much. I just, all the light bulbs in my head went off and I was like, I would kill to work on this. And then luckily they said, you can work on this. But I miss Colbert every day. Like I wish I could see him every day. He's so wonderful. And one of the qualities that he has and Robert and Tina have too, coming from Late Night and Tina coming from Second City, Colbert coming from Second City, they're all creatures of improv. So they all are yes-anders. So you hit the ball to them, they hit it back funnier, and then you hit it back. And, you know, it's like you're always building.
The density of jokes is a conscious decision, right?
Yes. I remember one time at Kimmy Schmidt, we went to the Emmys. The show was nominated. And I was talking to Robert and some other writers. And it's like, it's a shame they don't have a category for most writing. Then we would win.
It's so relentlessly funny. But how many drafts are you guys having to get through to get it at that level?
Well, let's see. How do we do it? We basically, once you get a story broken into beats, somebody writes up an outline, and then like a writer will, or two writers will go off and, you know, write up the draft. And then you bring it back to the room and all discuss like what's working, what's not working, what, you know, just to get it in shape. Can we beat this? Or I have a joke hole here. Can you help me here? Or what do you think this, how does this play? Whatever. And you know, you work an hour on something that then you end up cutting later, like make it perfect and then cut it. You know, it'll be something really benign and silly, like, how does this person's voicemail sound? And you spent so long crafting that, and then you're like, we don't need to hear it. So then there's a table read, and you hear everything said out loud by the actors. And then you get a good idea of what's working, what's not working. You get network notes. Tina will often give me her script that has check marks next to things that she likes, or like a B next to something, like maybe you want to beat that. You just check things that are working. Like a big check is like, okay, we love this. It's like a mini check. You're like, maybe. And then, you know, no check at all. You're like, maybe we should like fix this. And a B is like, definitely, let's not do whatever we tried to do.
There. So a B is as bad as it gets.
A B is like, let's beat that. I mean, but the thing that I think is really freeing is there's a lack of ego. I mean, you obviously want people to like your draft when you hand it in and you want it to work. But you also are just fully aware that the room is going to fix it together.
How many of that primary cast had you worked with?
I had met Busy before because she did a guest role on Kimmy Schmidt. And Paula, I had met maybe a couple times. But I was a huge fan of, just because I loved her writing at SNL, because she worked at SNL for 18 years as a writer. I had not met Sarah Bareilles or Renee before the show.
I don't feel comfortable just calling her Renee. I have to refer to her as
Renee Elise Goldsberry.
So like everyone, I sort of knew about her because of Hamilton. And then I got obsessed with her about that. This was all before I'd watched your show. And the idea that someone was as talented as she is and then could show up and you're like, ooh, good luck, because you're going to be acting alongside like Paula Pell and Busy Phillips. I really hope you got this. You were really good in Hamilton, and she is unbelievable as a comic actor. Right? It's insane. It really is bizarre.
I think it's so exciting when people get to see somebody have a new skill they didn't know they had.
Did you know she could do the thing going into the vocal ad lib in a split second? Was that something you knew when you were writing, or is that something you wrote once you knew she could do it?
You know what? Great question. Almost as if I wrote it, the question for you, so that I could tell you this. But basically, in the beginning, there was one line, and I think the line was maybe in the pilot, and she's trying to get back to the, you know, what she's owed in show business because of the voice coming out of my mouth, and she sang the voice coming out of my mouth. And I think it was scripted that it's supposed to be sung. And it was so funny. And just hearing her burst into song midline, we were like, we have to write a lot more of that, but not too much so that we're not leaning on it all the time. Overusing it.
Meredith, throughout this interview, have you been stood up the entire time?
At my standing desk. Oh,
you have a standing desk?
I have a standing desk that I've never used the standing element until I experienced a little bit of sciatica for the first time in my life.
Oh.
And then now I don't sit down. I'm trying not to sit down as much because I have like writer injuries from sitting too much over the years. It's so sad. It's such a bummer way to have an injury.
No, I think it would be a bummer way to have an injury if it was like, oh, that Meredith and all of her dreams. But your dreams come true. So I think it's a great way to have an injury.
Yeah, you don't feel like an athlete, but...
No, but you're an athlete of the mind.
When I first was a writer, my first job ever was this show, Best Week Ever. It was this clip show. And then there were some more senior writers, and they had a bunch of writer injuries. Like, one guy had a sprained ankle that I was like, how did it happen? And he's like, I don't know. I was just sitting here. And then another writer had just had thumb surgery from carpal tunnel issues and stuff.
And you're a huge Muppets fan, right?
Oh, I love the Muppets. Oh my gosh. I almost said, when you asked me who my idol was, I almost said Kermit.
Well, I wondered if Dawn is the Kermit on this show. I think sometimes, like, these ensemble shows, they need a Kermit.
She is kind of the heart and soul. That she's the more grounded one, although she gets to be plenty weird and funny, and she's not just playing a straight role at all.
No, but neither is Kermit. Neither's Kermit.
No, true. Exactly. That's Kermit's
sometimes
great.
But getting used to that.
I see some similarities there.
And is Wiki Miss Piggy?
Oh my gosh, wait, is this show The Muppets?
I don't know if Summer is Gonzo.
Yeah,
I can't to know what to do with the other two. It's less easy.
Who would be who? But yeah, you can Muppetify a lot of shows.
Can we throw some lines at you and you tell us the first memory or association that comes into your head? My favorite. It's episode one. What are we going to do about Kosovo, y'all?
Yeah, that one, I'm trying to remember how that happened. We wanted her to say something that didn't match on the third one. We had a few options. They were all equally uninformed world things.
But so perfectly placed at that moment in history as well, I think.
She's doing like, she's doing a straddle on top of like a Trans Am at night.
The hiatus for hiatus.
Wait, was that Tina? That might have been a Tina. I can't remember. I'm going to say it's Tina.
What about Ho Spice?
Ho Spice is this writer, John Mahone. I tell everyone, like, I'm like, that's one of my favorite jokes of the series. He also had a joke last season that I loved, which was when Wiki's talking about not being charitable. And she goes, I mean, I go to these parties just because they're parties. I mean, I went to one for renal failure. And I'm like, why am I even here? I don't even have a renus. I was like, yes. So funny.
Who did Tiny Butts Forever?
I believe that was me. I always liked how tiny and flat the butts of the 90s were. The jeans with like a one-tooth zipper. And from the side, the girl would disappear.
Do you have time to relax? Do you ever relax, or are you always working?
I actually like working more than not working. I don't like being too idle. I kind of don't know what to do with myself.
Can you enjoy just lying on a beach?
I'm not like a beach reader.
You're an upright, you're upright. You're
I'm at my standing desk.
You're an upright woman.
I always feel like I'm lazy. And maybe that's the story I tell myself.
Look at what you've done with your life. Of course you're not lazy.
But I do feel like I am somehow lazy. And so that always is like running a little bit in my head where I'm like, get up.
You have to let
go
of that.
But you know what part of the reason I think I'm lazy is? And I read something that freed me of that a little bit. So my natural clock in me is like a vampire. I love the night. I like to stay up late. I like to work late. I like to write, and I think when you're a night person and you then have to sleep a little bit later, you just think you're a piece of crap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And then I read an article that was like, hey, night people, stop shaming yourself. It's in your DNA.
What are you watching at the moment?
What are we watching?
Do you and your husband watch stuff together? You must, because all that business
together. We definitely watch stuff together. We like who doesn't like a good documentary?
What was the last good one that you saw?
The last one that really, I feel like we were a couple that, like, whenever we saw another couple, we were like, have you seen that? You know, that's, we have a topic. That crazy doc Love Has Won about.
Oh my God. We were exactly the same. It was unbelievable.
Were you repulsed or intrigued by her dead blue body that they show in the opening?
I did not like seeing that.
Oh my God. I could not stop looking at her.
Really? I just felt there's such a sadness to it. I just feel like they sort of watched, somebody die.
They did.
We're calling alcohol medicine. It's really bleak.
And can you enjoy comedy or?
I'm trying to think of some shows that really get me. I love The Righteous Gemstones. Mm. It really, really makes me laugh in a way that few things can. I mean, obviously loved 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt and stuff, but I used to love Arrested Development. That was one of my favorites. I love sketches. I like to watch. I still love sketch comedy when it's great. I Think You Should Leave. That show's really funny.
Anyway, I just am the biggest fan, and it is
I think it is
like the best show. And as someone who's about to turn 45, like being with all these women who are like over the age of 40 is just fucking
they're all so
thrilling.
Funny too.
Just
they're
thrilling.
So funny.
Are you gonna do more?
She probably can't say.
I'd like to do more. I have to wait and see if someone will give me money. I really love writing for these characters. You know when you feel you're like, oh, I've got more in the chamber there, just more to do.
Meredith Scardino.
She likes me. She really likes me. Do you think she liked me?
I think she really liked you. And I think she liked me slightly less.
I think she liked you too.
No, I just think she liked you more. This happens to me from time to time.
It happens to me from time to time as well.
I think people probably have a stronger reaction to you, generally.
We're both lovable. Should we leave it there? We're both a couple of lovable, sweet dreamers.
How are your happiness levels with the amount and quality of email we've received this week?
Oh, it's pretty good, actually. But that doesn't mean that you can take your foot off the gas. You need to keep giving me things. You need to keep joining the Patreon. Keep telling your friends. Keep emailing me with your thoughts for my hit. Lots of news in the opioid crisis, have you heard?
No.
Quite a few people have sent this to me, and I'm not real across the details, but broadly what I was able to understand is the Sacklers are now trying to make money off of another drug that you can give someone if they've had an opioid overdose.
Wow.
I know. So it's like a nasal spray, and it's a lot easier to give to someone in an overdose state, and therefore it's much more effective, but it's really expensive.
I wish everything could be either a nasal spray or on a sugar cube. Why does everything have to be down a needle?
I don't think this is the point that everyone's taking from this. But anyway, scandal.
But you're hoping that maybe there'll be a whole raft of dramas commissioned about this nasal spray.
Yeah, maybe I'm hoping for that. Okay, this first email comes from Katie Sadler. Katie writes, "Dear Firecrotch and Normcore, longtime listener, first time emailer. I always love that. First-time emailers, what a special love I have for these people. They're being so brave after so long. I was compelled to get in touch after Jeff said he was impressed by how committed to his look Noel Fielding is. And following that thought, also Robert Smith, another great example. They both found one look and they've stuck to it. Yes, this is true. But is this something to be impressed by? No, Jeff. I don't think it is."
So I've got my reasons for thinking it is, but let me hear what Katie's got to say.
She continues, "I am someone who grew their hair gray out in lockdown. This is partly because I was forced to, and partly because it dawned on me that various hairdressers and Jonathan Van Ness had been sensitively trying to tell me for years was in fact true. And that's that the things you do to make yourself look younger eventually start to make you look older. Noel and Robert are the most perfect examples of this."
Now, this is not what I admire about the people who find a look and stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
I like that they've taken that element of choice out of their day and then they can get on with whatever else it is they're doing.
Yes, I like that. But I kind of agree with Katie, and I don't want to get, you know, you don't want to get too nasty or too much of anything when you're talking about...
You don't want to get too nasty.
Well, I don't want to get too nasty when I'm talking about someone's looks.
Uh-huh.
Can I keep reading what she says?
Please do.
"I would love to see Noel Fielding stripped of all that armor." Yes. "I feel like I can't see him for hair dye, eyeliner, skinny jeans, and loud jumpers. This is how I feel. I'm sure he's incredibly handsome under there. I think so too, Noel. If only he had the confidence to move forward. I understand why people need to commit themselves to looking like they did at the age they felt their most beautiful or sexy or dynamic or interesting. But in my experience, there is freedom and confidence to be found in actually having the balls to look your age. I really appreciate what you say, Katie. You've helped me understand how I feel about Noel Fielding, but I'm still going to keep coloring my hair, but maybe for another 10 years. Katie signs off. Love your show so much. Thank you. She says she hasn't subscribed to the Patreon yet, but she will when she earns more money and she tells everyone about us.
In a way, that's even better than joining the Patreon.
Don't tell them that. Joining the Patreon is best, but please keep telling everyone.
This comes from Martin. You like the name Martin?
No. Sorry, Martin. I don't dislike it, but like, was the name Martin ever in the running of something I would name my child? No. But I don't, you just forced me to insult someone who's done us a beautiful favor of writing into our podcast.
The reason I did actually is I've got half memory of you doing some impersonation of the name Martin being said in a British accent.
Oh, yes. That's because when I was here as a student, when I was 20 years old, my American roommate dated a guy named Martin, and she would do an impression of him going, Hi, it's Martin. That's all I remember.
I now have no idea why that was memorable to me. It must have been something you told us in the very early stages of a relationship.
Everything I said to you was interesting. How depressing.
Martin says, can I recommend Derek Del Guardio's In and of Itself on Disney? He is, amongst other things, a magician.
Let him keep going.
Okay. And he did a show for 50 nights. And Frank Oz, love Frank Oz.
You do love Frank Oz.
Worry, he's a bit cantankerous these days. Frank Oz filmed them and edited them into one program. It's a show all about identity and how we see ourselves. Oh, you see, now Martin says, having had no desire to watch an illusionist before, and because Derek doesn't have the performance skills of a Sarah Baron.
Thanks, Martin. Sorry I said that about your name.
I found the first 45 minutes to be just okay. The last 45, however, especially the last trick, is so special and emotional that it is breathtaking. I think word of mouth is now so strong that the audience is filled with celebs from Bill Gates to just about everyone. I would love to hear your views on it, Martin Schofield. Martin, I am going to watch this and I'm going to tell you my views on it because I am intrigued. He also says, P.S. I did jury duty for 4 months a few years back and it is a lot like the Channel 4 show.
Great.
I liked it when David Blaine hung himself in that big box next to the Thames and then it became this real unifying thing for the country to go and insult him.
Oh my God, I don't think I told you this. So I was listening to the Off Menu podcast and they had on Jada Pinkett Smith. David Blaine came up. And her thing was really like, isn't he the most amazing talent that has ever existed? And they were like, oh, well, some of his tricks didn't go over so well when he did them in the UK.
I love that Paul McCartney, who has very meticulously managed his public image since his early 20s. That was one of the big slip-ups, that he'd had a bit to drink and went and shouted the C word at David Blaine.
So great.
Like 50 odd years or whatever it was of being very careful about how he came across in terms of publicity. And that was the thing. But that is how we responded as a nation.
It's one of the things that makes me proudest to live here. This email is from Naomi, who writes, hi, Sarah and Jeff. I've seen very little hype or conversation around the Channel 4 drama True Love, which I really enjoyed. It's about some quite dark topics, so enjoyed feels like the wrong word, but I really liked its depiction of euthanasia, late-in-life love, and complicated family relationships. It had some twists I wasn't expecting and includes some fantastic cast members, particularly a woman named Lindsay Duncan. It didn't blow me away and definitely isn't up there with Succession, but I think it deserves more attention than it's gotten as well, worth a watch. Well, Naomi, I have very mixed feelings about this because generally I love the idea of, hey, this is good enough that people should be talking about it and they're not. But Naomi, a thing I think I'm working out about myself as I age is I think euthanasia is perhaps something that puts the poison in me and I can't quite do it, even though I think it's wonderful and I think it should be like everyone should do it all the time, always. But I've seen a couple of things where I'm actually watching euthanasia and I don't have the constitution for it.
Let's keep Sarah's happiness levels up high. Keep your recommendations and thoughts coming in, please. The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
This week, Meredith Scardino liked to watch Righteous Gemstones, which you can find on HBO and Sky and Now TV, and I Think You Should Leave and Arrested Development, both on Netflix. Sarah watched Past Lives on Netflix. I watched Bunch of Amateurs, which is in the Storyville section of BBC iPlayer, and we watched Shogun, which is on Disney Plus here and FX in the States.
The spring is in the air. If you guys are curious about how my hedges have been getting on, they've been getting on okay. You commented on them the other day, which you are blind, I would say, to outdoor space that connects to your own property.
Yeah, I think of it almost like a backdrop on a set in a theatre.
It's very weird.
We could have a painted set out there and it wouldn't make any difference to me.
But actually what I would say is, in a way that's really quite sad and permeates through other aspects of your life, is it like when the outdoor part of our property is looking really nice, you don't notice it. But when our hedge was burning out because it was eaten by all those insects, we had an infestation.
Looked like a petrified forest.
You notice that. We don't notice it when it looks beautiful. Anyway, even you, is the point, made a comment about, like, the hedge was doing well. spring is in the air. My hedge is blooming and blossoming. Have a wonderful spring and a wonderful week overall. Goodbye.